What's going on, guys? On this pod, we got a lot to talk about. Start off with the Nunes memo. We're going to go into the State of the Union, talk a little bit about President Trump's messaging there. And then we're going to take a deep dive into the State Department to kind of uncover what's going on in there and why it is so concerning. So let's go. Welcome to Excuse My Politics, presented by Bad News Media. Whew, was it a doozy on the sound last week? We're going to go ahead and try to get that figured out. We're dealing with a rinky-dink system right now. We're pushing through live. At some point, I'll get it figured out for you guys. But until then, we're just going to push on through, and we're moving on in a big way. Maggie Homerman on Thursday basically decided that she wanted to drop a bomb on us after I had gotten done recording. If you don't follow Maggie Haberman on Twitter, I strongly recommend it. She has done some fantastic reporting for the New York Times, especially during the Trump administration. But she dropped a report in partnering with Michael Schmidt at the New York Times. Basically, the report stated that back in June, amongst reports that Mueller was investigating Trump for obstruction of justice, Donald Trump decided to say, why don't I go ahead and fire the guy? And you got to kind of admire him for a moment, because this is one of those moments where Donald Trump is just in his fucking mood. I'm doing whatever I want. He thinks he's playing out a version of The Apprentice White House edition where he can just fire anybody left and right. He had just come off the firing of Jim Comey, probably feeling pretty good about himself. And he decided to himself, let's go ahead and fire another one. It wasn't until White House counsel Donald McGahn, hopefully I pronounced his name right there, decided, Donnie, that's probably not a good idea. And if you ask me to do it, I'm quitting. So somehow Donald Trump managed to hire a competent human, he might be the only one working in this White House, who decided that it wasn't in the best interest of the president to fire Mueller for an investigation in which he was investigating Trump for obstruction of justice. Go figure. And this may have actually saved Donald Trump's presidency for now. So brilliant move on McGahn's part there. Horrible move for the rest of the country because we got to put up with this guy for a little bit longer. But once again, Fox News came in with perfect timing. There was a great clip by Sean Hannity that night, and I want to go ahead and play this out for you now.
Now tonight, for example, they're trying to change the story. At this hour, the New York Times is trying to distract you. They have a story that Trump wanted Mueller fired sometime last June, and our sources, and I've checked in with many of them, they're not confirming that tonight. And the president's attorney dismissed the story and says, no comment, we're not going there. And how many times has the New York Times and others gotten it wrong? All right, so we have sources tonight just confirming to Ed Henry that, maybe Donald Trump wanted to fire the special counsel for conflict. Does he not have the right to raise those questions? You know, we'll deal with this tomorrow night. We have a shocking video of the day to bring you, by the way.
This is beautiful from Sean Hannity. It is what we have come to expect. I mean, when you are in that bullshit factory at Fox News, you got to be churning out bullshit at record paces. Who has time to wait and see if your sources can confirm what every other news outlet had already been able to confirm? But they are the fake news media. This is a real journalistic institution at Fox News where we do hard fact journalism. Sean Hannity is one of the best at what he does. Don't tell me he isn't. When he gets into that booth and he gets that propaganda machine moving, it is a thing of beauty to watch. It's rotting out our country, but it is a thing of beauty that somebody can be that bad at their job and still be viewed as good by a good portion of our country. So I need to move back into this, though, because I digressed. So now we figured out that Trump wanted to fire Mueller. They told him, you can't do that. He's been pissed about it ever since. We also found out that he forced out Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe, a man who he once called and told his wife was a loser for losing an election in Virginia before hanging up on him because he was pissed about the way the FBI handled the James Comey firing. Really, all that meant was they allowed Jim Comey to fly home on the FBI jet, and Trump was pissed about that. He also asked Rod Rosenstein, his handpicked deputy attorney general, if he was on, quote, "Are you on my team?" which is wildly inappropriate. But nothing has been more dangerous, and nothing has been more dangerous than we found out this week, than what is currently playing out in the House of Representatives. So we need to go ahead and turn to our attention, because boy, oh boy, is it a doozy with what's going on. If you're not familiar, there is a steaming pile of elephant crap that is a David Nunes memo. And what this memo is, it's worked its way out of the House Intelligence Committee. It's gone to the floor of the House of Representatives. There is a party line vote all the way down to have this released to the public. It is now sitting at the White House being reviewed. And ever since then, it has been falling apart for Republicans, because once again, they don't have it together, and all of their stories are getting blown up in their face. So what this memo is all about is it's claiming that there is widespread abuse and conspiracy at the FBI and DOJ around the Trump campaign and the Trump administration. Last week, you heard about a secret society at the FBI, which was a wildly taken out of context text between two FBI agents who were dating and romantically involved. It surrounded a gag gift at the FBI. They took the context of a joke out of context, presented it to the world as a conspiracy and secret society, and then we learned that it was nothing. We've also learned that the agent in question was actually one of the agents who helped create the release of the James Comey letter that was an in-kind contribution to the Trump administration when they were running a campaign against Hillary. And while it wasn't the determining factor, it definitely helped decrease some votes from Hillary. So we've learned kind of that information this week. And now this memo is being presented by Republicans as proof of corruption at the FBI and widespread abuse of power. So what is this in relation to? It is in relation to a FISA warrant that was granted to surveil on former campaign member Carter Page. Now, the memo, which we haven't yet seen, but reports are saying focuses around the presentation of the Steele dossier, now famous Steele dossier, in getting that FISA application. What it doesn't provide context to is all the other evidence that was used to get that FISA warrant. So to be granted a FISA warrant, you have to present an accumulation of evidence in order for a judge to sign off on it. One piece of evidence is not going to get you a FISA warrant. And the other part that's been left out is that we have since learned through fantastic reporting that the Steele dossier was didn't spur the investigation into the Trump campaign and Russian interference, and it did not create this FISA warrant. What it did was it collaborated with information that the FBI and DOJ already had, and that is important. Context is incredibly important, especially when we're dealing with matters of national security and evidence around national security. It'd be like if Bill Belichick came out and said, "I just traded Tom Brady," walked off his interview without clarifying that it was in his fantasy league, and then Massachusetts burned down to the ground over anger over this. Because that's basically what the Republicans are doing. They are going to use this memo to try to burn down the FBI and the Mueller investigation without the context needed to present to the American public. And it's something you're going to hear a lot about over the next couple weeks is that this is all being done to be more transparent, which is a load of crap, because the Democrats have compiled a memo that is a rebuttal to this and goes point for point or shot for shot with this memo in providing context and clarity that makes this memo wildly inaccurate. The FBI has released a statement about it, and I'm going to read that to you. The FBI takes seriously its obligations to the FISA court and its compliance with procedures overseen by career professionals in the Department of Justice and FBI. We are committed to working with appropriate oversight entities to ensure the continuing integrity of the FISA process. With regard to the House Intelligence Committee memorandum, The FBI was provided a limited opportunity to review the info the day before the committee voted to release it. As expressed during our initial review, we have given grave concern about material omission of facts that fundamentally impact the memo's accuracy. The head of the FBI, also, who was appointed by Donald Trump, has now, there are reports now saying that he will quit if this memo is released for a couple of reasons. One, the intelligence community hasn't had enough time to make sure that source material and ways of gathering information are not going to be exposed in this memo, which, if you remember a little while ago, was a huge concern in how you handled classified information by the Republicans. It's what they dragged Hillary through the mud on, but they seem to not care anymore, and you could make the argument that they never cared. It was all about political reasons. But there's that, as well as the Department of Justice, who the FBI reports to and who oversees the FBI, checks and balances, also calls this an extremely reckless exercise, this memo, because it leaves out important information. The other thing we've learned, too, which is very concerning, is there are reports that not even Nunes has reviewed the information or the source information that this memo is based off of, but he has now changed the memo that was voted on the House. So the memo that's sitting at the White House is not the same memo that the House approved. So there's a lot going on here. It's a lot to digest. There's going to be some more fantastic reporting, I'm sure, coming up. We are going to go ahead and be compiling some information for you because we just don't have enough time today to get through everything. This is kind of what you need to know as far as an update. Check out Bad News Media. Follow us on Facebook at Bad News Media 1 to keep up to date with this. We're going to be publishing more, so just follow along. But I do also want to move on to the State of the Union, because that was another thing that happened this week that was important just for an idea of what's going on in the mind of Trump. Now, State of the Unions are pretty overhyped in general. Really, the only purpose they serve is for a president to try to outline a policy agenda that he or she, if we have a woman president in the future, God willing, would like to see enacted. And for Trump, he doesn't have a lot of that, so it was going to be interesting to see kind of what he came out with. Now, there were leaks earlier, which have been happening since the dawn of time. Basically, the White House wants to get ahead of kind of what their messaging is going to be, let reporters and the audience know kind of what to listen out for. One of the big topics that you could have guessed ahead of time but was confirmed was going to be about the economy. Now, this is something that Democrats and Republicans love to talk about when they're going through stump speeches or trying to run campaigns. They often take credit for things that they don't deserve credit for, and Trump is no different. So we're going to point out some of the obvious mistakes that he can't take really credit for because you guys need to know about them. But this is something that politicians on both sides of the aisle do. Now, he started off kind of talking about the efforts that are undergoing to try to recover from some pretty tragic events in this country. He mentioned the Las Vegas shooting to start off his speech. He also stated that to everyone still recovering in Texas, Florida, Louisiana, Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, California, and everywhere else, we are with you. We love you. We will pull together. Which is a nice message, but unfortunately, it's just a message. His actions do not back that up. FEMA this week is pulling out of Puerto Rico. There's 450,000 people without power is the estimate currently. So not really with Puerto Rico, but with the rest of the country, he's doing all right. Then he moved into the economy, where he's going to take credit for a lot of things that he does not deserve credit for. To start, he took credit for 2.4 million jobs being created since the election, which is key, and included 200,000 new jobs in manufacturing. So one of the things Trump loves to do is start his statistical numbers from the election. So he's not even sworn into office yet. Obama's still president, and he's trying to take credit for some measures because it boosts the numbers. So since he's taken office, there's been 1.8 million jobs created, and it's been the slowest gain in jobs since 2010. It actually lags behind 5 out of the last 7 years of the Obama era. So not too great there. He also claimed that wages are stagnant and that we're finally seeing a rise in wages thanks to the almighty Donald Trump. That's not true. Wages have been trending upwards since 2014, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They're actually growing slower in the first year of Trump's presidency. He talked about African unemployment, the shot of the African-American caucus is hilarious because they are not happy with him. He claimed that African unemployment stands at the lowest rate ever recorded, which it is. But during his campaign, he ripped African youth unemployment rates, saying it was at 58%. It was actually at 19.2% at the time, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, to give you a little context of his history with this matter. Since 2010, African unemployment rate has actually been falling. So at its height, it was at 16.8%. It has fallen to 7.7% by the end of the Obama era and is currently sitting at 6.8%. So can't really take credit for that, but he's trying anyway. Another thing he tried to take credit for was the Chrysler plant moving to Michigan, which is fantastic for the people of Michigan. I mean, that's going to be a real good positive impact on their lives. But that $1 billion investment was already set in motion before the election. It was actually starting to be planned in 2015. The other thing, which shouldn't have been surprising, is he tried to take credit for the stock market. That has smashed some records. It has gained, he said it gained $8 trillion in value, and that is great news for American 401ks, retirement pensions, and college savings. He was spot on with the $8 trillion mark. The stock market has created $8 trillion in wealth from the election, 6.9 since he took office. The problem is the great for American retirements, basically, because that's overstating it. Only about 50% of Americans own stock directly through their retirement funds, according to a Gallup survey. And according to a paper written by NYU economist Edward Wolf, around 80% of all stock value is held by the top 10%. So when you're claiming this great rise in economic value from the stock market, what you're really doing is you're promoting income inequality. Now, the stock market is great. We want it to be performing well. But at this point in time, not enough Americans are invested in it to really feel the impact. Only the top 10% really control an overwhelming majority of that. So yeah, they're getting richer, but it's not trickling down. So one other thing he talked about was his tax cuts and the relief it's giving to middle class and small businesses. That's a stretch. More than three quarters of that $1.5 trillion tax cut is going to individuals who earn more than $200,000 a year in taxable income, which is only about 5% of taxpayers. So everybody below $200,000 is not really getting some relief. It also came out that the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, reported to Congress that they're going to need to consider rising the debt ceiling earlier than anticipated to account for the revenue loss brought on by this tax legislation. So there goes their tax revenue neutral plan that they had been touting. So this is Trump's economic message, and this is something that Democrats should jump all over. We're in an election year this year. We should have no problem talking about the economy because we have a president, a Democratic president, who is smack dab in the middle between Bush-era policy and we're going to have Trump policy on the other side. We should talk about our economic record. We should tout, when you put Democrats in office, what the economy does, and we should be willing to have those fights. So now that we've kind of done that, I do want to bring into something else. The other thing that really I have to say is he talked about the military. And this is something that bugs me because this is one of those points where the rhetoric and language that is used around supporting the military is not backed up by Republican action right now. So he talked about the VA, and what has been happening there is criminal. I mean, we are doing a disservice to the men and women who have put it on the line for America, and that needs to be fixed. And I hope he can achieve that. That would be phenomenal if he could do that, because it has been a mess that has eluded multiple presidencies. But he had a line in there that, "I will not stop until our veterans are proudly taken care of," which has been my promise to them from the very beginning of this great journey. And I have a problem with that line, because when the government shut down recently, Claire McCaskill, a senator from Missouri, brought to the floor the opportunity to vote to make sure military members received pay and that death benefits were paid out. And Mitch McConnell struck that down. And you didn't hear Donald Trump raising his voice about it. The Republicans turned their back when the military was going to need us the most during a government shutdown. They were not going to pay out death benefits. Luckily, that government shutdown didn't go too long, but that is ridiculous. And this idea that you get to do stump speeches and play on the American passion to serve our military family and members and not back up your words with action is despicable. So Just wanted to talk about that. He did mention about trying to lower drug prices, which was great. That's something he's going to be able to work out with the Democrats. The other fun part was he talked about economic surrender. And he said that the economic surrender in relation to trade is over. The truth is that under his administration, China is destroying us in trade. We originally worked with 11 other countries on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. One of Trump's first orders as president was to pull out of that deal, leaving the remaining 9 countries in to figure it out. Well, unfortunately, since then, Canada has announced that on January 3rd, that the remaining 11 countries of the Trans-Pacific Partnership have agreed to revise trade agreements without the U.S., which is going to make it more difficult for U.S. to sell goods and services, and China comes out on top. So much for surrendering trade, because the rest of the world is moving on without us. Then he got into the speech that was disturbing, to say the least. This is the part where Stephen Miller got to go to town. As Rick Wilson, a GOP commentator on Twitter, said, Steve Miller wrote this in the nude with such excitement. I thought that was pretty funny. But he moved to immigration in a way where he basically stuck a middle finger to the Democrats and is going to make immigration talks a lot tougher. He preyed on America's fear by using MS-13. And that played just as you would expect. If you didn't turn into the after coverage, and I unfortunately did, but Rick Santorum jumped all over that. He basically made the argument to the MS-13 part of the speech that it was great because all we ever hear about Dreamers is how great they are and how much they contribute, but we don't talk enough about the negative effects like an MS-13 gang member or the crime that's brought on from this. And that is complete crap. So the reason that is crap and the reason you hear so many great things about Dreamers is because they are fantastic and they can't be part of the DACA program unless they meet a strict line of criteria. That strict line of criteria is they have to have come to the United States before their 16th birthday, currently be in school, have graduated or obtained a certification of completion from high school, have obtained a general education development GED certification, or are an honorable discharge veteran of the Coast Guard or Armed Forces of the United States, have not been convicted of a felony, significant misdemeanor, or 3 or more other misdemeanors, and otherwise not pose a threat to national security or public safety. So Dreamers are in fact good people. You cannot compare them to MS-13 because MS-13 gang members do not qualify for DACA status. And that is why what Rick Santorum jumped on afterwards and other Republicans are arguing that we've got a big problem with these Dreamers and everything else was crap. But he did lay out probably his only real significant policy agenda, and it was in 4 pillars. And some of the pillars are great, some of the pillars are not so great. In the first pillar, he said, the first pillar of our framework generally offers a path to citizenship for 1.8 million illegal immigrants who were brought here by their parents at a young age. That covers almost 3 times more people than the previous administration. Under our plan, those who meet the education and work requirements and show good moral character will be able to become full citizens of the United States. That is fantastic news if he stands by that. That is what Democrats and a good portion, part of the Republican Party is fighting for. Those are the Dreamers. That would be fantastic. We should support that pillar. Let's go make that get. Let's make that happen. He presented his second pillar as fully securing the border. That means a border wall on the southern border. It means hiring more heroes like CJ, somebody he had highlighted earlier in his speech, to keep out of our communities. Critical on our plans closes the terrible loopholes exploited by criminal terrorists to enter our country and finally ends the dangerous practices of catch and release. Now, this is something where Democrats can offer some wiggle room in our negotiations around immigration reform. I don't see any problem with giving money to border security. The wall is a dumb idea. I don't have enough time to cover how dumb it is. So instead, go to YouTube or Google, type in John Oliver border wall. Let him do it for you. He does it beautifully. It's fantastic. He can thank me later. go watch that. But Democrats shouldn't be upset if we give funding as part of this negotiation for border security. I think that's something that is within reason. I don't see any reason necessarily to fight that. They're, depending on what they ask for is a different question, but sending some border security, not a big deal. Then he broke into the last part of his pillars, which are terrible. The third pillar, he said, ends the visa program, a program that randomly hands out green cards without any regard for skill, merit, or safety of our people. That is not true. So individuals who apply for the visa program have to at least have a high school diploma, the equivalent or 2 years of work experience, which the State Department mandates, to be eligible for the program. The term lottery for this applies to the selection process, which is randomized by a computer drawing. Once you get selected, though, you have to undergo background checks, interviews, medical tests before entering the country. Some applicants undergo additional in-depth review, in which they, if they are considered a security risk. And so that's the process. In 2017, a report was done by Government Accountability Office. It did not point to substantial fraud risk within this program. Now, there are some arguments, though, because this is not a perfect system around security. It is, as the State Department said, it's difficult in verifying identities because it has a security-based implication that is heavily relying on name-based databases. So it's not a perfect system. We can definitely look to potentially review it, but he's stretching the matter a little bit. The fourth pillar, which was the most concerning, I think, and something that I do want to spend some time on, is around the phrase chain migration. This is going to be a huge point of discussion in our immigration debate that this country is heading for. The Republicans love this phrase. It has some racial undertones to it. But here's what you need to know about chain migration. In his fourth pillar, he says the final pillar protects the nuclear family by ending chain migration. Under the current broken system, a single immigrant can bring in virtually unlimited number of distant relatives. That is a lie, flat-out lie. This is somebody who does not understand migration because his advisor who wrote this section, Stephen Miller, has no idea what he's talking about. So let's give you some background as to what this is. What chain migration is in the process they're referring to is the ability for a U.S. citizen to petition for a green card for a spouse, child, parent, or sibling. Notice I didn't say anything about distant relative. They can only apply for a spouse, child, parents, or siblings. It's even stricter for green card holders. They can only petition for a spouse or unmarried child. So basically what this is, it's a letter of recommendation. Think about it. So a letter of recommendation helps you get a job, but it doesn't guarantee you the job. That's all this really is. It's giving some priority to citizens who want to sponsor a direct relative or family member, and it gives them a little leg up. Now, this is not a fast system. According to the State Department, there's nearly 4 million people that are waiting to get off this list. So this policy is not great. And the irony here is that about 70% of America has come here through what would be considered chain migration. It's the way America was built. Trump's mother and paternal grandparents came into this country that way. Mike Pence's grandfather came into this way. And funny enough, Stephen Miller, the man who is extremely anti-immigrant, his great grandfather came into the country through what would be considered chain migration. So when you hear chain migration, make sure you question it. They do, oftentimes it is being misrepresented, and it is something that is a load of crap. So that was your weekly recap. There's a lot going on there. But I want to move into a topic that is involving kind of an area that a lot of Americans maybe don't know about because it doesn't get covered as often as it should and is going to cause long-term damage to the health of this country. There's two areas where Donald Trump is wreaking havoc on our country's institutions that are going to have long effects way after he's gone. The first is the judicial system. We don't even have close to enough time to cover that, so I'll break that down to you in another pod. The one I want to cover today is the State Department. So this week it came out that individuals at the State Department, career officials at the State Department who have worked under Republican and Democratic administrations trying to better our nation are being punished for working at the State Department under the Obama administration in trying to carry out the objectives of the Obama administration at the time. So here's a little background on the State Department. The State Department is our first executive department to be established in this country. It was established in 1789 and has done tremendous work to further the goals of our country. Their mission is as such. The U.S. State Department advances the interest of the American people, their safety, and economic prosperity by leading Americans' foreign policy through diplomacy, advocacy, and assistance. So it's important to make sure that we have a strong State Department because they're going to be responsible for maintaining the international relations of the United States, negotiating treaties, agreements with other foreign entities, and representing the United States at the United Nations. So when Trump took over, he appointed Rex Tillerson to head the State Department. So he came in, he was highly recommended by former Defense Secretary Robert Gates and former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Both of them were from the Bush administration. He was viewed highly because of his vast knowledge of foreign governments and their leaders from his time at ExxonMobil and running that organization. But it became apparent through his transition that this was probably not going to go well, and it hasn't gone well. So the transition department officials were told by the Trump transition team that they were not to contact Tillerson at all. There was a quote in an article by the New York Times that said the attitude was that anyone who worked with the Obama administration must be suspect, one Trump official stated, which is quite possibly the worst way to go about viewing the State Department. These individuals are career officials. They served, as I said, both under Republican and Democratic offices and administrations. Their goal is not to be a political entity. They do not support one party over the other. They support America. They are Americans' tools to further our goals, depending on who the administration is. So if it's a Republican, they often get their instructions from the top guy or woman who's appointed by the president. They try to further our relationships abroad. So this is a ridiculous way to think about it. And then we got confirmation that it was going really bad in December. This information came from an article written by the New York Times called Rex Tillerson and the Unraveling of the State Department. So back in December, Nikki Haley, who's Trump's nominee and now the ambassador to the United Nations, set up a conference call with two senior State Department officials, Christy Kenney, who is the State Department's counselor, and Patrick Kennedy, the undersecretary of the State for Management. Haley wanted to ask questions about the logistics of her new job, as anybody would, to make sure that you hit the ground running. When the word got back to the Trump transition team, the two department officials were reprimanded and were told never to speak with Haley again. Now, Kenny and Kennedy are among a small group of foreign policy professionals who hold the Foreign Service equivalent to a 3- or 4-star general rank in the military. These are senior diplomats who are tasked with handling America's most complicated global challenges, everything from Russia's annex to Crimea to the North Korean pursuit for weapons of mass destruction. So these are some of our top professionals at the Department of Justice who have served under every administration for the last decade or so. So it's pretty terrible that this was the way kind of their relationship got started with the Trump administration. It's really terrible the way we've been handling these career officials who have sacrificed a lot of their life to work for the benefit of this country. Now, a process that you might not be familiar with is during each transition, members at the State Department submit basically these letters of resignation upon the end of the prior administration. Then what happens is the incoming Secretary of State and his or her team go about whether to keep these diplomats on in their current jobs. And usually they just get re-upped because it pays to have individuals who have decades worth of experience talking with negotiators in South Korea as far as the North Korean deal, people who have worked in the Middle East and understand the complexity that is there. These are not simple issues to understand, so it pays to have people who have long experience in these jobs, so they typically just re-up them. Or they're rotated into sleepy ambassadorships. Basically, they're paid for the great work they've done at the State Department. But when Tillerson came in, they received no word back from him once they sent these letters in, which led to one senior official who had worked under Hillary Clinton, who had worked under Vice President Dick Cheney, couldn't get two more opposite people to work under, to retire. Now, others showed up on Monday after the inauguration as work as usual. 2 days later, though, Kennedy was told to retire and given 3 days to clean out his office. Kennedy had spent 44 years in foreign service. He was not described as particularly a political person. His focus was instead on management and operation. He had been appointed under President Bush to the undersecretary position, but he had become a central figure in conservative conspiracy theories about the Benghazi and Clinton private email server. Tillerson aides later joked that this request for him to retire was something out of the Soviet Union, like dragging a political foe out into the street and shooting him in the head so as to send a message to the others. I mean, these people are not good people. Kennedy gave 44 years to this country to try to further our objectives through the State Department, and this is how he's getting treated. A few weeks later, Kenny, who was the counselor at the State Department to the number five policy official, was told that her services were no longer needed and she should retire. In the weeks after that, half a dozen other top diplomats were shown the door, fired, forced into retirement, or warehoused at university fellowships. And there was a great quote in this article, and it was stated as, "If you took the entire three-star and four-star corps of the military and said leave, Congress would go crazy." And this is, it's so hard to imagine what is happening. We really won't be able to kind of understand the long-term effects of this for a while. But the purge that is happening at the State Department should be setting alarm bells off all over the place. But because we have a party in power in Congress, the check and balance on all of this, who is not interested in governing, a lot of this is being just swept up under the rug. The other problem here is that we fired all of these career diplomats and had no plan to replace them. We've run into a huge hiring problem because of Trump. The Never Trump campaign was largely supported by members of the Republican foreign policy circles. So this has not been something that, because Donald Trump is an egomaniac, has not let go. A lot of them during the campaign signed letters of opposition against the president and united against him, not only because of ideological reasons, but also because they view him as unfit for the office and a danger. And that criticism has never left Donald Trump's mind. There's a report stating that there was an official who was up for a job, but because he liked a retweet of Marco Rubio's joke about Trump's small hands during the campaign, Trump threw his application basically out the window. So the hiring pool is pretty small and unqualified, so much so that Tillerson has had to reject a lot of the names sent over by the White House for positions because they don't meet the qualifications for the actual job that they're applying for. So with so few qualified people working, other individuals have had to pick up the slack, and the responsibility is overwhelming. An example that was laid out in this article was Brian Hook, who is the head of the department's Office of Policy and Planning, doing the work of about 30 people as of October, because so many assistant secretary positions, which include areas responsible for Asia, Middle East, South America, all these are pretty important regions, are still vacant. I mean, Trump hasn't even appointed an ambassador to South Korea. He had one, but because he opposes the view of what some would describe as like a first punch strategy, where we should basically have a military strike about North Korea, which is just a first punch, and then say, okay, are we good? Because he doesn't support that, and he supports diplomatic measures, Trump has thrown his application out the window. So this is pretty startling information. And the long-term effects of not having a well-funded, well-run State Department where we have good employees working at that is going to cripple America's ability to stay as top dogs and to be able to help keep the world in some form of contained chaos. I mean, there are some really complex issues out there. We haven't been able to figure out the Middle East. The situation on the Korean Peninsula is extremely tense, but we don't have the people in place to help manage these events. So it's really a disservice. Now, we haven't even really gotten to the scariest part, which is even with all of these cuts to our diplomats at the State Department, Tillerson is still planning on cutting around 2,000 people at State. This could cripple the department for years to come. A senior State Department official was quoted, and he said, "You can't have captains if you don't have lieutenants. You can't have majors if you don't have captains," which sums this up perfectly, because you have to have people build up to these positions that are have huge responsibilities and huge impacts, not only for America, but the world, and we don't have that. So if you're thinking, holy crap, what can I do? I mean, you've just laid out a House of Representatives that's in a mess over a memo involving the FBI. We've got really no checks and balances on a president. We have a State Department that it's eroding away. We haven't even gotten to the judicial system. This seems all pretty overwhelming, and it is overwhelming, but there is a lot that you can do about this, but you can't start that process until you do the one thing that's most important, and that is voting in this country. This country isn't the greatest because we always do things right the first time around. This country is the greatest country on the planet because its people demand to be great. We strive for greatness. We continue to push through to progress in this country. The mountain of progression is tough to climb, but you know what? We do it. We may trip, we may stumble, we may roll down that hill 15 feet, but we always get up, we dust ourselves off, and we keep pushing forward. This year is crucial for us. We can change the world and get the checks and balances we need to make sure this government works. This little thing we like to call democracy only works if we have voter participation. So this is the year to get off Twitter, get off Facebook, make sure you still listen to Excuse My Politics, but you get into the voting booth. I need my Republicans out there to vote for better representatives because I know there are good Republicans out there. I am friends with a lot of them, but we need to get better representation for your party in office because the ones you have, they stink. And for the Democrats, we need to get out and we need to vote because when we vote, we change the world. This is the year we fight the notion that your vote doesn't matter. Yes, we have a messed up way of electing a president through the Electoral College, but you know what? The president still has to win the popular vote in the state to get the electoral votes. Your governor still has to win the popular state. Your senators have to win the popular vote. Your House of Representatives needs to win the popular vote. Every single person needs to win the popular vote, so your vote matters. In the House of Representatives in Virginia, there was an election decided by one single vote. It is important for you to get up and vote. This is the year you are the change. Be the change you want to see. It's up to you. So here's how we're going to do it. You're going to either go to vote.org or you're going to look up your Secretary of State's website to figure out if you're registered to vote. If you're not, you're going to get registered. You can do it on your Secretary of State's website or you can go to www.usa.gov.gov/register-2-vote. I'll put it in the bio and you're going to get yourself signed up to vote. Then you're going to make sure your friends and family are registered to vote. And then in November, you're going to show up at that ballot box and you're going to initiate change. You're going to be the change this year. And that is what our goal is. That is how we change this outcome. That is how we fix this country and we continue to push forward and progress forward. And with that being said, I'm going to conclude the show. It's been a fun one. Next week, I'm going to try to bring you a little bit of a different format. We're going to play around with some things. But until then, I'm going to let the king himself, Sean Hannity, play us out. Go ahead, Sean. Play that bullshit one more time for me.
Now, tonight, for example, they're trying to change the story. At this hour, the New York Times is trying to distract you. They have a story that Trump wanted Mueller fired sometime last June, and our sources, and I've checked in with many of them, they're not confirming that tonight. And the president's attorney dismissed the story and says, no, no comment, we're not going there. And how many times has the New York Times and others gotten it wrong? All right, so we have sources tonight just confirming to Ed Henry that, yeah, maybe Donald Trump wanted to fire the special counsel for conflict. Does he not have the right to raise those questions? you know, we'll deal with this tomorrow night. We have a shocking video of the day to bring you, by the way. This footage comes to us from Arizona, where you see that red...